This means that Donald Trump will be the 45th president of the United States.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back to the 45th podcast, folks. Rabia here, and I'm here with Susan, and we have a special guest this week. But first, let me say hi to Susan. How you doing?
Hey, Rabia. I think we're actually missing a live Rose Garden speech right now from Trump.
Oh, are we? Because, he's in the Rose Garden announcing the new NAFTA, right?
It's not called new NAFTA. It's called USMCA or something.
It's the new NAFTA. That's
NAFTA
all it is.
NAFTA is now prohibited. NAFTA is bad, thank you. Can't use that word anymore.
I really wish Trudeau was just like, screw you, I'm not doing this. Like, done. We're not making a deal with you. But yeah, I guess we're missing it. But we'll circle back to it next week if it's something that's really remarkably different from NAFTA, I guess. Maybe it'd be important to cover. But I am very, very excited. We haven't had a guest on in a while, actually. And I reached out to this guest completely arrogantly, thinking, I'm just going to give this a shot. And he responded and said, yes. So I'm so excited. We have joining us this week comedian Hari Kandabulu. And I want to tell you guys a little bit about him, although he doesn't need much of an introduction if you know anything about the world of political comedy. But he's a very well-known comedian, writer, and a fellow podcaster. So, you know, one of ours. New York Times has called him one of the most exciting political comedians in stand-up today. And for good reason. His comedy is just sharp, smart, biting, hilarious. He's been on every, you know, done the whole circuit, Late Night Show with David Letterman, Conan, Jimmy Kimmel, John Oliver stuff. I just recently watched his Netflix special that came out this year called Warn Your Relatives. That's what it's called, Warn Your Relatives. And we've had your friend and former co-host Kamau Bell on the show a couple times before. You guys had a podcast called Politically Reactive, and now you co-host the Kandabulu Brothers podcast with his brother. So welcome to the show, Hari.
Thank you, Rabia. Thank you, Susan. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my gosh. So excited to have you on. You know, I also watched you and your mom appear a couple of times in different things online. And she's awesome. And you guys look exactly alike. And we know where you get your funny bone from. She's great.
Yeah, she's incredibly funny. And I've wanted her to do a podcast for a while, but she's insistent on waiting till she retires. So that's the plan.
Wait, what does she do? What's her full-time gig?
She works in a cath lab in a hospital. She manages a cath lab in a hospital. She was a doctor in India. So, I mean,
Of course she was.
Of course she was.
And you and I are just failed. We're just failed doctors, basically.
Correct.
I know I am. I did learn that you have a master's in human rights and that you were a former immigrant rights organizer. And so, I mean, that's a career that you kind of stepped away from, or like kind of what happened? Can you tell us how you moved from that into comedy?
Sure. I mean, I always did comedy. I mean, comedy's always been a part of my life. And when I was living in Seattle working as an immigrant rights organizer for an organization that was actually headed up by Pramila Jayapal, who is the congresswoman from Seattle. Mm-hmm. And we're very close. We're friends. She's a mentor. It was an incredible job. And I was working with like refugees and people in immigration detention and families
Around what time was this?
05 to 07. It was the time of the big immigration marches that were happening around the country too.
Right.
And so, you know, I did comedy at night partly as a stress relief because I always loved it. And I got discovered by the HBO Comedy Festival when I was out there. Then I ended up on Jimmy Kimmel Live. And I had this whole career happen within months that I had not anticipated.
Oh my God.
So, you know,
that's amazing.
So it was an unconventional path to comedy. And, you know, and then after that, I wasn't, you know, at that time, there weren't that many South Asians as there are now. It's only 10 years ago or 10, 15 years ago. And so I ended up like getting a master's in human rights because human rights seemed like a much more stable and lucrative field.
Oh yeah, lots of money there.
I wonder what like the circle of people with like a master's in human rights and like stand-up comedy is.
I think it's
one.
Me.
Maybe one. Yeah, it's an overlap of one. How have your parents been vis-a-vis your? And I'm only saying this once again as an immigrant child of immigrant parents, South Asia. I know how these things go. I mean, it seems your mom's like you're really kind of supportive and excited about all of this. And how's the response been from your family?
I mean, I wouldn't say she's like overly excited. My dad is excited. Like my dad Googles me and my brother every day. My mom is My mom is like, you know, she's kind of even keeled about it, and you know, she'll tell me when it wasn't my best work, and she'll tell me when it was good. And she's very like, when I was on Kimmel when I was 23, everybody that I knew was excited and thought it was a big deal. My mom said, you know, my mom said you were nervous. It wasn't your best. And looking back on it, she was absolutely right. You know, but it was hard to hear. But my mom is, you know, if she's going to tell me the truth, my mom doesn't bullshit me.
Mom's got a mom, right? Because we just want our kids to do it better. I've got a daughter who's almost 22. And, you know, I tell her like it is, only out of love. But has your comedy always been political, by the way? Or
no, I mean, yes and no. Like, you know, I think I started when I was 17. And then by the time I was 20, it started to get political. So, you know, the vast majority of my career, there's stuff that, you know, talked about race and the world. But, you know, early on, like, what were my examples for what it was like to be funny and to be Indian? It was Apu and, like, using accents and talking about my family in ways that weren't necessarily sophisticated. So that's kind of where it started. And then, you know, post 9/11, you know, and you know this as South Asian, like, things felt different. Everything felt different. And so you know, I was reacting to hate crimes in our community. I was reacting to deportations and detentions. And it felt ridiculous for me to not talk about those things when I had people listening to me.
Right. Now, I mean, I know in 2017, your documentary, The Problem with Apu, came out. And I actually haven't seen it, but I've heard a lot about it. Can you tell us a little bit about what is The Problem with Apu?
Sure. First of all, don't feel bad for not seeing it. Most people have not seen it. And what's nice is most people who haven't seen it hate the film, even though they haven't seen it. Because I think I'm going after something that is like The Simpsons has never really been criticized other than like it hasn't been the best show in the world for the last 20 years. It's still been good, but it hasn't been what it was. But other than that, no one's ever criticized anything in terms of its content or its characters. And I guess I was the first to really do that, which is shocking to me. But the show is about how what it was like to grow up as a South Asian American and only have one major form of representation. And that representation is a cartoon on The Simpsons that's voiced by a white guy and is the stereotype. And Apu is the only character we had. And it was based on stereotypes, an accent that is an absurd, over-the-top accent. And so that has an impact, you know, when you are coming of age and this is how you know the world sees you. And also in terms of, you know, I think representation is so important because for so many people in this country and around the world, you know, how you're depicted in media is who you are. And, you know, especially post 9/11, I saw the impact of, oh, they don't see us as fully human. They don't see us as one of them. And that's why they're willing to send our families away and they're willing to hurt us because they see a disconnect between what being American is and what we are. And, you know, I think Apu didn't help because Apu is this absurd figure. And that's all we had other than like we had terrorists as brown people and we had harmless. And when you are worried about a threat, what are you worried about? You're not worried about the convenience store owner. You're worrying about the other image. And there's a great range of humanity between convenience store owner and terrorist. And so I feel like, you know, that was very much ignored. And for me, like this documentary is about why representation is important, how this is part of a history of minstrelsy in this country that stems way back, something black people have had to deal with forever. And I had the privilege of talking to Whoopi Goldberg about that experience and how she has... Yeah, and she in the movie, she talks about having a collection of black Americana, of racist imagery of people in blackface, and she keeps it in her house as a reminder to people as to where we were and the fact that this progress didn't come out of anywhere, right? And when racist things happen, there's a history in that, and I feel like this documentary is my version of Whoopi's collection.
You know, I have a confession that until I... And I remember when I first started hearing about the film, and I think I saw you speak about it in different interviews and stuff. And honestly, that was like I mean, I grew up with the same, obviously, the same one stereotype representation. But maybe some of it's so internalized for us that it never jumped out to me as something that was offensive, insulting, just because I kind of laughed along with it. And it wasn't until... Like, you made me think more deeply about it. And I'll be honest, you know, I'm a Muslim American. I'm very, you know, I understand very well kind of like the history of the stereotypes of Muslims, like, you know, as Arabs with big crooked noses and all this stuff. There's a great documentary called Real Bad Arabs, R-E-E-L, which shows a whole history of like how Arabs and Muslims are shown, represented in Hollywood. It's fantastic. And I've been very aware of that and much less aware of like the stereotyping of South Asians in general. And of course, now we're all kind of lumped together. But so I thank you for raising our awareness. I'm definitely going to check it out and watch it with my family and maybe my girls if it's age appropriate. But urging our listeners also to check it out.
Susan and I love our cats. Mr. Beans, Ragnarok, and Gringo are no joke. They are pretty important personalities in our life. They're big parts of our lives. And you know what? I love my cats so much that they actually have their own Twitter account. And Mr. Beans has a Facebook page. Now, you know that's a special kind of love. But the one thing I don't love about being a cat owner is dealing with cat litter. It's disgusting. It's messy. It's smelly. It's heavy, okay? Conventional cat litter is outright, I gotta say it, barbaric. What day and age are we living in? But not since I switched to Pretty Litter. I've been using this litter for a couple of months. It's amazing. Pretty Litter is kitty litter 2.0. It is shipped right to your door in a small lightweight bag that lasts me the entire month. I can actually move this bag. I'm not kidding. The other litter boxes that we buy, like, I can't move them. I gotta wait for my husband to come and like pick up the litter so I can change it. And there's no more running to the pet store or storing huge boxes and open bags of cat litter in your closet. And it has a next level odor protection. I am very sensitive to odors. I mean, I have a nose like a hound dog. And we keep our litter in a laundry room next to the kitchen. And I'm telling you, every time I walk by and I get a little whiff, it ruins my day, but it doesn't happen anymore because Pretty Litter uses super absorbent crystals that trap and conceal odor and moisture. No mess, no fuss, no smell. Forget about the dirty clay or compost that is so gross to clean up. And the best part about Pretty Litter for people like me who love, love, love their cats is that it monitors your cat's health. Pretty Litter changes color to detect any underlying illnesses that need urgent medical care. And that saves you money, stress, and of course, potentially your cat's life. So do what I did and make the switch to Pretty Litter today by visiting prettylitter.com and use the promo code 45th for 20% off your first order. That's prettylitter.com, promo code 45th for 20% off. prettylitter.com, promo code 45th.
I want to ask you one more thing before we get into this week's conversation. In 2008, when Barack Obama became president or won the election, whatever, were you still working in immigrant rights and organizing, or had you moved completely out of that?
I mean, at that point, I just graduated from grad school and I was starting my comedy career. That was like the beginning of my comedy career.
Okay. Well, the reason I was asking is because I know a lot of folks who worked, and I'm an immigration lawyer professionally. A lot of people who worked in this space were very, very hopeful that the Obama administration would bring some relief. There would be some comprehensive immigration reform. You know, it seemed like the GOP and the left, they were getting closer on these issues, and then nothing happened. And that was really disappointing.
Yeah, it was very frustrating. Like, there was a complacency. Especially early on, which is, you know, because, you know, we had the Democrats had the House and the Senate at that time. And granted, you know, there were some moderate Democrats that were kind of very much on the border. But still, you have the majority, you would think that would put you in a position, and you know, that we didn't seize it. And, you know, as we see it now, like, oh, my God, like in some weird way, Trump is the bizarro version of Obama that I wanted. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like, I wanted that figure that like would radically change things and push us so much further to the left and to that I think a lot of us thought that's what we were getting in Obama, which is maybe unreal. No, it was definitely unrealistic, but like somebody who could just do what they had to do to get us to where we had to be. And instead Trump shows up, and Trump is the one that like, I don't give a shit, I'm gonna do whatever I want. Right. And it's, you know, I feel like that often happens with the left, unfortunately. There's a degree of complacency and there's a degree of, you know, maybe like proper decorum. And, you know, I don't think sometimes there's room to be polite when you're talking about justice.
I mean, I do think that Trump is pushing the left for the left, but I also think one of the silver linings of this administration is the folks who have been working on these issues for decades and have been canaries in the coal mine are actually being taken seriously. People are seeing how tremendously damaging the discretionary powers, like when it comes to immigration issues, can be. They've been used for national security stuff. Now it's for other things. I mean, kids are being moved around in the middle of the night. I just read a story this morning that hundreds of children were moved, like literally in the middle of the night, like at midnight, they were being roused from the sleep, telling them to pick up your backpacks and some snacks and taken to tents on the border just overnight. And so these are like this is straight up fascism to me. Yeah. I mean, Susan, yeah. Did you read the story?
Yeah,
did you read this morning?
This was not a very funny week, I gotta say. It's probably the least funny week so far in Trump's reign.
Well, okay, so let's go back to last week and let's start with Thursday. Now, in our last week's episode, you know, we did talk about the allegations that have arisen against Kavanaugh. And then we got to hear from one of the, the initial accuser, which is Dr. Christine Blasey Ford. Did both of you guys watch the hearings on Thursday? Who watched
it? I
did.
I got nothing done last week. I was not going to watch all of it, and I watched all of it.
I was in India at the time, so I watched as much as I could after the fact.
Yeah. Wait, where are you now?
Oh, I'm in New York now. I was in India for
okay.
I was in India for 3 days last week, which was
very bizarre.
Yeah, I won the GQ India Comedian of the Year.
Congratulations! That's awesome.
Thank you. It's very weird because it was the GQ Men of the Year Awards, and it was very bizarre to see what was happening in the U.S. while I was winning one of the Men of the Year awards. Like, do I really want this? Do I really want this? Is this a thing
poorly timed.
Oh, it's incredibly poorly timed.
Well, I mean, congrats. That's awesome. I can't believe that you must be jet lagged still, because I've done a 4-day trip to Pakistan before, and it's pretty brutal. So, worth the trip, I would assume. So you are excused from not having watched it, but I'm sure you've been following the news and hearing about it. But let's talk a little bit about with Dr. Ford's testimony, because that's how the day opened up. Yeah. Susan, you and I were online, I think, most of the day tweeting about it, talking about it. I did have to pop in and out because of baby stuff. But Dr. Ford, so I'm just reading this today, that apparently she was offered, and she was asked this during you know, after she gave her statement, and then she was questioned by this sex crimes prosecutor, which I also want to talk about. But she was asked about the fact that she was apparently offered a chance to testify privately. She wouldn't have to travel. But she, I guess, chose to testify publicly in front of the Senate. But in her response on Thursday, she said, well, I didn't know I kind of could do that. That wasn't made clear to me. So I don't know what happened there, but regardless.
If the right is using this as their talking point, they have nothing else to go on right now. What seems to have happened is that she was trying to avoid going to D.C., and she wanted to possibly give public testimony at home. And as she said in her testimony, she realized that was not possible. So she came to D.C.
And why did she want to do that? She wanted to do that because she didn't like to fly?
Well, she just didn't want – I mean, if they can come to you, it's better. I mean, this is already a stressful enough situation. And she says, like, she realized what she was asking for was not realistic. And what the response was like, well, we could have done it in secret and had our aides go out there, staffers go out there and interview you. And that's not what she was talking about. She was talking about having like, the whole thing done out there, which she realized was not possible, so she came here. She was not talking about having a secret meeting with some Republican staffers in California.
Got it. I don't really know what kind of points the right is trying to win with this one. But anyhow, she began the hearing with saying some – I mean, the whole thing was very powerful, her statement. And she said, you know, I'm here today not because I want to be. I'm terrified. I'm here because I believe it's my civic duty to tell you what happened to me while Brett Kavanaugh and I were in high school. Do you want to take us through some of the testimony, Susan? And then we can discuss some of the –
talk about the format they used here. The format was designed to try and make it as quick as possible and to try and avoid getting – too far into detail for anyone. So it was a 5-minute format. Each senator got 5 minutes to question her. And the Republicans, because they're all old white dudes, and they thought that they could not effectively handle questioning her themselves, hired Rachel Mitchell, a Maricopa County sex crimes prosecutor, to come and do their questions for them. So they yielded their time to her to do the questions, which was incredibly cowardly and just blatantly showing that they think they're incapable of even handling this topic. I mean, if you can't do it, get off the Judiciary Committee, full stop. But the end result was that we had 5-minute questions, like it was Republican, Democrat, for 55 minutes.
5 minutes each time after she gave her statement.
So you had 5 minutes from Rachel Mitchell, 5 minutes from a Democrat, 5 minutes from Rachel Mitchell, 5 minutes from a Democrat. And it was really discombobulated and not ideal in any respect, but it certainly did not help Kavanaugh's case because, and here's where Christine Blasey Ford is. She's a unique and extraordinary person. And I know in the future, they're going to hold her up as like the standard, like, why can't this a victim be like this? No, the number of victims who can do what she did is very small.
Right.
Like she went above and beyond the call of duty. She was also extremely credible and knowledgeable and well-spoken. So they're trying to pick holes in what she said, but it's hard because most people who are totally honest and trying to do a good job would have done far worse than she did.
Well, her allegations were fairly familiar with that. We talked about it last week, but you know, she attended this and she doesn't have the exact dates. And that's something also they're picking at, but she attended a party in Bethesda, Maryland, 1982, I think, in the summer. And she is a small gathering. She remembers Brett Kavanaugh and his friend Mark Judge being quite drunk, visibly drunk. She went upstairs to use the bathroom, but she was pushed into a bedroom and then held down. And she says that Kavanaugh got on top of her and you know, she felt like he was going to attempt to rape her. He was trying to take off her clothes. And then he put his hand over her mouth, which terrified her because she thought he might accidentally kill her. And I think then Mark Judge, I mean, they were one of the things she says she remembers very clearly from that interaction, like when she was asked by one of the senators, what's your most clear memory? She says it was them laughing. I mean, I can't, that was horrifying to hear. I mean, the whole day was shit for women, by the way, online. I think it was just so many women were reliving so many moments in their lives. Although it was traumatizing in a way, there was also a little bit of healing, I think, for everybody, a lot of people to be experiencing this collectively. Anyhow, she was able to escape. And when she asked, she was asked by a senator about her certainty that it was Kavanaugh, she leaned into the mic and she said, 100%.
I feel like, I mean, with the previous one regarding the lawyer, I mean, it was a real Sarah Palin move. You know what I mean? Like, oh, they got a woman, then we'll bring a woman in. Like, it wasn't particularly thoughtful. It's the same kind of like thinking of, well, we'll neutralize this as if it's that simple. And it feels like when they were asking her questions, like regarding her flying in and who she met with, part of me feels like, you know, that were they trying to lay a foundation that the Democrats set this up? And it felt like that felt like part of it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And they might have been able to do so if they'd not been hamstrung by their own 5 minute rounds of question, because Rachel Mitchell couldn't get anywhere. And I'm sure she's a great prosecutor in terms of like technique. I have no idea. I'm making that up, but I assume she's okay, like good at it. But no prosecutor could really do an effective job at what she was trying to do, which is discredit the victim in that situation.
Susan, you know, that's not generally the job of a prosecutor.
No, in any prosecution. It's not. No, we'll get into that because there's a lot to say there. But one of the weirdest moments, jumping ahead a bit, but she was brought in to question the witnesses. Presumably, she was going to question all of them. But when the Kavanaugh portion of the hearing started, she got in one round of questions, and the Republican senators jumped in and are like, nope, you're gone now. And she just disappeared. Like, bye?
Did she actually get up and leave?
No, or like she's
she there, was, but like, she couldn't answer anymore.
Shoved into a corner. No one said bye to her. Like, she was just like forgotten.
So there's a few things that I think are, let's talk a little bit about what's notable from Dr. Ford's testimony. One of the things, and I hadn't really understood the timeline of how this all happened, but the timeline itself defeats the argument of Republicans that this is like a Democratic setup. And that was that, first of all, we know she has her corroborating evidence, which is that she has, you know, notes from 2012 when she's in therapy. She's told her husband, she's told other people, like, you know, she's named that this perp was a judge and one day he might be a Supreme Court justice. She's expressed these kinds of things to people without naming him directly. Actually, no, I think she said that she told her husband and her husband remembers her telling her it was Kavanaugh. But when she realized, you know, that Trump is going to be nominating Supreme Court, you know, candidates, and she saw the short list. So before Kavanaugh was the actual nominee, when she saw the short list is when she contacted her senator. And her senator is Feinstein, right?
She actually contacted her congressman first, congresswoman.
Oh, okay. Her local, her state one, okay.
Yeah. And then she went to Feinstein. And we went over last week how Feinstein's gotten a lot of flack over this. But she, no one has credibly put forth a description of why she did anything wrong here that I've seen. She was given this in confidence. She kept it in confidence.
Right. One of the accusations, this was made even like right there in the hearing, Grassley, and maybe I lost her shit, was that you know, fine, like, and Kavanaugh said the same thing, like, you know, she had this letter that Ford wrote, then she didn't release it. They timed it so then it would mess up the whole confirmation, blah, blah, blah. But she didn't release it until the victim gave permission, right? Like, that's basically what happened.
Yeah. There were a lot of ugly accusations going around about Feinstein, like, leaking this. Like, she's the one behind it, masterminding it. And it is very clear that however this all got out, it was not Feinstein. Because the very first story was that Intercept article that was framed as an attack on Feinstein. And talking about how she wouldn't release the letter and, like, criticizing her for her, like, it was like, without the letter, it's taken a life on its own. Now everyone wants to know what's inside of it, and no one knows because Feinstein won't share. So the literal point of that story was that Feinstein wouldn't leak it. What seems to have happened is that probably someone Ford had talked to, or someone who just heard it from whatever rumor mill is going on in California and D.C., leaked it to the press. The press started sniffing around, and they got rumors about it, details about it, but not the actual letter itself. There's nothing to do with the letter leaking at all, despite all the accusations and the Cruz and Graham and, well, Grassley not so much. He and Feinstein seemed to have a better working relationship. But they were just accusing her of leaking this letter, and she's like, no, I did not. And obviously, if she was going to leak it, she's been in this politics game long enough where she'd leak it to an outlet that wouldn't frame it as an attack on her.
You know, I think a lot of this is basically them throwing crap and seeing what sticks, and also distracting, trying to distract people from, like, the substance of the allegations. Hadi, I want to ask you a question because you're a man, and in the last few weeks, I've been asking men this as I encounter them. These allegations, it's interesting to me because when I heard these allegations, they're shocking allegations to me. It's not the kind, you know, there's the boys will be, we hear that kind of shit, boys will be boys. This is not boys will be boys. This is like criminal violent behavior. I have, but I, what I'm seeing online, I'm seeing like a total mix. I'm seeing on one hand, like, and this is my experience, that boys in my high school didn't do this stuff. Like, this is not normal. I've had guys tell me that. I've had other people are saying, oh no, these kind of stories were common in our high school. You're a guy. Is this the kind of story that makes you think back in high school, guys did stuff? Yeah, we kind of heard stuff like, or you're like, this is unreal.
I mean, it depended on the kind of high school and background you had. Like, I went to a public school in New York, and as far as I knew, like, we weren't a big party school, and it was kind of a nerd school, and I didn't hear stories about that. Not to say there weren't stories like this that existed, but certainly in college, you know, I heard, you know, rumors of this and that, and, like, you know, we didn't have a frat scene, but certainly, you know, like, I think all campuses have a certain drinking culture and right. Student athletes, and this is the place you avoid to go. This isn't safe for you to go. Like, every place has a, you know, every college has a avoid that building. And we certainly had that too. I think that to me, this is from the beginning when I heard the story, it didn't seem completely shocking to me. Like, it didn't seem like if it came from my friend group, yeah. But in terms of what was actually described, I'm like, there is definitely like a culture of like douchebag bros that feel entitled and do whatever they want.
I mean, this particular school seemed to have like a kind of an overwhelming culture of that. I mean, at least from like the yearbook and other kinds of things, it just seems like this is a very not an unusual thing for this group of guys.
Elite bro privilege.
Well, I guess so. And we saw it. We saw it in full force when Kavanaugh got a chance to say his piece. But before we move on to that, because that was batshit crazy, Susan, I want to ask you about the fact that they brought in a sex crimes prosecutor. I did not understand. I understand them bringing in a woman, like you said, the Palin move. That makes sense because they're thinking optics and they're also idiots. But they could have brought in, for example, someone who had been, to me, would have made more sense in the situation, I think, unless it has to be a lawyer, like, let's say, a sexual abuse counselor or somebody else who's able to, like, assess, you know, a victim.
It makes perfect sense. Their goal was to try and, like, cross-examine her. Their goal was to make her on trial. It makes perfect sense from their view.
How well do you think she did?
Yeah, go ahead. I don't think she could have done a good job, given the format.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they were handling, I mean, I wouldn't expect the Republicans to handle this with any sensitivity. Like, they want to discredit this woman and destroy this woman as opposed to, let's get to the bottom of this. Like, what do you, you know, this.
They had to get it out of the way. They had to get it out of the way, and it wasn't anything that actually, like, they were like, we're going to confirm him anyways, for the most part.
I will say, they have treated her a bit differently in that they don't feel capable of doing a full-on attack on her. That might change.
Right.
But for so up till now, it's kind of wavering now, but for most of this time, they have felt, for whatever reason, and we now know why, because of how credible she is, that they couldn't call her a liar. So they went, they've been trying to hint at this mix-up theory because they did not feel
safe
attacking her full-on as a liar. Because she's clearly not, like, making this up. It's, like, full-on lying. They believe it's a Democratic plot somehow. They aren't quite able to go all the way and say that she herself is doing this as part of some conspiracy.
I mean, unless the plot is like, I'm going to basically accuse whoever happens to be the nominee. Like, that's the letter she wrote to find. Like, that, she gave the red flag as soon as that shortlist came out. So it just, it can't hold water. But I want to, like, so Rachel Maddow did, she did a masterful job that evening, kind of breaking down the day's testimony and everything. And she has a short little compilation I want us to hear that are some of the highlights of Kavanaugh's opening statement.
My family and my name have been totally and permanently destroyed by vicious and false additional accusations. You have replaced advice and consent with search and destroy. Since my nomination in July, there's been a frenzy on the left to come up with something, anything, to block my confirmation. People have been willing to do anything, to make any physical threat against my family, to send any violent email to my wife, to make any kind of allegation against me and against my friends, to blow me up and take me down. You sowed the wind. For decades to come, I fear that the whole country will reap the whirlwind. The behavior of several of the Democratic members of this committee at my hearing a few weeks ago was an embarrassment. But at least it was just a good old-fashioned attempt at borking. Those efforts didn't work. When I did at least okay enough at the hearings that it looked like I might actually get confirmed, a new tactic was needed. Some of you were lying in wait and had it ready. A long series of false last-minute smears designed to scare me and drive me out of the process before any hearing occurred. You've tried hard. You've given it your all. No one can question your effort. But your coordinated and well-funded effort to destroy my good name and destroy my family will not drive me out. This whole two-week effort has been a calculated and orchestrated political hit, fueled with apparent pent-up anger about President Trump and the 2016 election, fear that has been unfairly stoked about my judicial record, revenge on behalf of the Clintons.
That was crazy. Oh, my God. Like, I don't know what I expected, but that was not it. He even if all of these allegations are untrue, he is fully disqualified from sitting on the Supreme Court. Horrifyingly so.
I mean, the second you start talking about a plot against you and that different forces are working against you, like, you've immediately politicized yourself, and that makes you, I think, ineligible. If any other judge was to say something like that and clearly make this partisan in that way, it's done.
It's a big Clintonian conspiracy.
It should be done. I mean, in his statement, he specifically cited, I mean, the whole thing was crazy, but he specifically identifies by name the 2016 election, political opposition to Trump, and revenge by the Clintons as a reason that he's being investigated for sexual assault. Like, he actually names those. He turns to the Democrats and he sneers at them. The way he was flipping, I've never seen anybody flip pages like that. He was so angry. He was weepy, though I saw no tears. What I thought was, I mean, there's so many things here to talk about, but he talked about his childhood as if he comes from an incredibly privileged background. He's his only child, okay? Fancy neighborhood. I remember he gave an interview a few weeks ago. He talked about, like, the streets of Bethesda, the rough streets of Bethesda. I can't afford to live in Bethesda. That's how fancy that place is. But he talks about it like he was raised in the hood and overcame street gangs or some shit. But he said he worked hard, got into Yale with no connections, and yesterday it was reported that, right, not true. He was legacy, meaning his, I think, father went to Yale as well, or grandfather, like one of those people. He talked a lot about, his calendar and working out with Tobin and Squee and PJ and
Like invoking this calendar as like paternal, like bonding and male masculinity and like true character, because he kept a fucking calendar. Spare me.
Well, also the names on the calendar are names that like were mentioned.
That like, matter.
Like Dr. Ford actually said, like, these are the people that were at the thing. And like there's a, I think I forgot what the date was on the calendar, but there's
July
a day.
July 1st.
Like those people would have been at that party. Like she listed the people. How would she know that?
I mean, we already know they're liars, because the very first this all started, Kavanaugh's response was, I was never at a party like that. A party that involved his friend Judge, his friend PJ, and him at a house somewhere. Oh, wait, July 1st, she went to someone's house for skis, a.k.a. Brewskis. Side note, he's also disqualified from the court for calling him skis. and he's got PJ there, he's got Mark Judge there, and he's got Ford's ex, I guess, boyfriend, but, you know, it was 80, so they weren't calling boyfriend. Ex-guy she was seeing, Squee, all there at a house drinking beers, just like he claimed that never happened.
Here's the thing, though. Do you remember the portion of the testimony where he talked about, he kept saying, we'll talk about the beer, but he knows exactly what the fuck he's doing. He knows July 1st, they were all there. And the reason he knows that is because he spends a good portion talking about how this kind of stuff could only have happened on the weekend, right? We only had time the weekend, but weekends I wasn't there. I was in DC. July 1st, I think, was a Thursday night. But he goes to this whole, and I was like, it's weird. It wasn't a weekend, but he makes a whole case about this, something, a party like that, because people had jobs and people blah, blah, blah. This could only have happened on a weekend. He already knew that July 1st, that there is a weekday that makes me look bad. So I got to lay out the argument. I got to like preempt it by saying, we know this could not have happened on a weeknight. And that's exactly when it probably happened. I'm going to ask you a question that I know the answer to. Would you buy a t-shirt for $50 if you knew it only cost $7 to make? I wouldn't. And with Everlane, you actually never have to, because you never overpay for quality clothes. Everlane only makes premium essentials. They use the finest materials, and there's no traditional markups. And they actually tell you their real costs, so you know you are never overpaying. Have you ever heard of that, by the way? Any kind of clothing or accessory manufacturer telling you how much it costs to make something? But Everlane wants you to know what you're paying for and why. They are radically transparent about every single step in the process, from the material to the use, to the ethical factories that they work with. And because Everlane sells directly to you, their prices are 30 to 50% lower than traditional retailers. And their clothes look better, cost less, and last longer. I recently got a few items from Everlane. They're beautifully made. A gorgeous, gorgeous clutch, a couple of pairs of shoes that are just classics, leather. I'm gonna wear them. I think I'm gonna wear these items forever. And they've got essentials like a cotton crew t-shirt that are exactly what they should be. Simple, stylish, made from quality materials. If you're looking for no frills, just quality essentials, well, Everlane's timeless essentials are just what you want. And right now, you can check out our personalized collection, when I say our, me and Susan's, at everlane.com/45th. Plus, you'll get free shipping on your first order. That's everlane.com/45th. Check it out, everlane.com/45th. And he talked a lot about beer. Let's listen to this.
We drank beer. She had one beer at the party and had beers with. Out and having some beers with friends, or just to meet up and have some beers. I mean, drinking beer, which I gladly do. I like
you
beer.
You have an answer that.
I like beer. I don't know if you do.
Okay.
Do you like beer, Senator, or not? What do you like to drink?
Next one is...
Senator, what do you like
Judge,
to drink?
Have
in
you...
In any event, we drank beer and still do. So whatever. I think you've probably had beers, Senator, and... So
you're saying there's never been a case where you drank so much that you didn't remember what happened the night before or part of what happened?
That's you're asking about. Yeah, blackout. I don't know. Have you?
Could you answer the question, Judge? That's not happened. Is that your answer?
Yeah, and I'm curious if you have.
I have no drinking problem, Judge.
Yeah, nor do I.
You know,
who doesn't like beer? Everyone likes beer. You like beer, right? I bet you like beer, you liar, hypocrite. Oh,
dude,
my God.
What was happening? What kind of meltdown was happening?
He obviously has alcohol issues or has them now. Like it's clearly someone who has had an alcohol dependency issue at some point. It's the exact same defensive behavior you'd expect to see. Maybe he's still trying to reach those 100 kegs.
Well, you know, one of the things when I was listening to, I was just shocked when he came out of the gate you know, belligerent and angry and all that. And I remembered, I think the day before or so, it was reported that Trump said that he needs to go hard. Kavanaugh needs to go hard. And I think this was him performing for Trump, right? In general. And then the drinking, he was questioned repeatedly about the drinking. He loved to keep saying, he kept saying, I love to talk, you know, I love beer, but he didn't want to talk about what beer did to him. He got pissed off every time he was questioned. When he was questioned about drinking too much, there was this first shocking exchange with Senator Amy Klobuchar. She set this question up, I thought, really compassionately. She's like, you know, my father was an alcoholic. He's still in AA. He's in his 90s. I understand it. Sometimes people drink to blackout. And like, she's giving him, you know, a lot of cushion here. And he comes back and he is a complete asshole. He's like, have you ever blacked out?
He did it to White House too, Senator Whitehouse.
Oh, right. He did to Senator Whitehouse as well.
I mean, it was just like classic textbook behavior of an alcoholic in denial and deflecting. He clearly has had alcohol issues at some point, if not still now.
There's also, I mean, I think this is probably an example of that too, but there's a degree of male fragility that he has throughout the thing. As soon as he's confronted with, you know, with this truth, he immediately crumbles. You know, he can't, you know, that it seemed like he was not able to handle, like, I could imagine if it was something else, he would have kept his cool. He would have, like, just bullshit his way through it. With this, though, he just immediately crumbled.
Deflects, yeah. And let's all not overlook the fact that he spent a great deal of the hearing just lying about anything and everything.
Can we talk about Booft and the Devil's Triangle?
We can talk about all that.
Okay, first of all, I want you both to tell me the truth. Which one of you knew before having to look it up what either one of those things were?
I still don't know what Booft is, but everyone know, if you've watched How I Met Your Mother, you know Devil's Triangle is.
What about you, honey?
No, I didn't know those particular terms, but I could tell that they weren't what he was claiming they were. If it's a drinking game, I feel like who has gone to college and has been in their 20s, I would have been somewhat familiar with the drinking game. So, yeah, it's obviously something terrible.
How was the drinking
game
played?
I'm glad that I wasn't the only one. I'm relieved to know that I wasn't the only one who was like, what are these things? I thought I'm in my 40s. Maybe I'm too old for this. I don't know. But anyway, go ahead.
I mean, so there's kind of a certain irony here is that we have this man telling absurd lies to cover up things that are not illegal, not even like that bad. Like, I really don't care if some dude, I care if he lies about it, but like some dude had very irresponsible yearbook supervision and wrote something bad in this yearbook. Okay, fine. But he's up here, and in order to, like, avoid embarrassing questions, lying on the stand, that sounds very familiar. It's almost like when he spent much of his start of his career, or mid-career, going after Clinton for perjury, saying that that was a big deal because he lied about an uncomfortable truth on the stand that was not relevant to the line of questioning before him. So this guy, like, committed the crime that he thought Clinton should be impeached for.
You know, because he lied. It's amazing.
And the other problem here is that not only, like, did he lie, but also all of his classmates know he's lying. So they all watch him go on TV, this guy who wants to go to the Supreme Court, and just tell blatant lies that they know from their own high school years. Like, that's not true.
He also, so Booft and Devil's Triangle, these are sexual terms, apparently. And he said in his testimony that I was not sexually active until, like, you know, well after high school. You know, it could be that he wasn't. He just lied about all the, you know, boys make up stuff. You know, maybe in the yearbook he wanted to sound all hard. But when he talked about the, is it Renata alumnus?
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't believe how he twisted that. That was kind of evil genius in a way, but mostly evil.
To make him the protector. To make him, like, to blame everyone else. As what he did is, like, what he did was to try and humiliate her. And then when someone tried to call him out on it, he's like, how dare you drag her name to the mud like this and embarrass her like this?
Well, also, like, the his whole claim of sexual activity that, you know, we were talking about earlier, like, what does that have to do with a rape attempt? I mean, like, yeah, like, I finally had sex after multiple rape attempts. Like, that's not
a winning argument.
That's not a winning argument. Like, the idea that those things are equated also is really troubling.
It is if you equate chastity with virtue.
Right. Also.
Right. So Durbin and others also tried, and Feinstein also tried to put him in a corner about why he wouldn't himself be interested in having the FBI investigate. And I want to hear this exchange. It's about a minute long or 2 minutes long between Durbin, Kavanaugh, and then Grassley jumps in. And it was like a complete circus, but let's listen to this.
I'm sure that the chairman at that point will understand that that is a reasonable request to finally put to rest these charges if they are false, or to prove them if they are not. You spent 2 years in the White House office that approved judicial nominees. You turned to the FBI over and over and over again for their work. Let's bring them in here and now. Turn to Don McGahn and tell him it's time to get this done. An FBI investigation is the only way to answer some of these questions.
Stop the clock. This committee is running this hearing. Not the White House, not Don McGahn, not even you as a nominee. We are here today because Dr. Ford asked for an opportunity here.
I welcome whatever the committee wants to do because I'm telling the truth.
I want to know what you want to do.
I'm telling the truth.
I want to know what you want to do, Judge.
I'm innocent of this charge.
Then you're prepared for an FBI investigation?
They don't reach conclusions. You reach the conclusions.
No,
Senator.
But they do investigate questions.
I'm innocent.
And you can't have it both ways, Judge. You can't say here at the beginning,
I wanted a hearing
moment, look, I welcome thing, any kind of investigation.
This thing was sprung on me. This thing was sprung at the last minute after being held by staff. You know,
Judge.
And I called for a hearing immediately.
Why would you resist that kind of investigation? Why would you resist that kind of investigation?
Senator, I wanted the hearing last week.
I'm asking about the FBI investigation.
The committee figures out how to ask the questions. I'll do whatever. I've been on the phone multiple times with committee counsel. I'll talk to
Judge Kavanaugh. Will you support an FBI investigation right now?
I will do whatever the committee wants to.
Personally, do you think that's the best thing for us to do? You won't answer?
At the end of this exchange, you know, Durbin keeps saying, just turn, he's like, turn around. Don McGahn is right behind you, White House counsel, and tell him, yeah, I want an FBI investigation. Let's stop this. Let's put these, you're saying you're innocent. Let's put these charges to rest. And Grassley jumps in and is like, oh, no, let's, nobody, only we control this and he can't do anything. He's like trying to protect him. And then Kavanaugh just stops responding. He has the most punchable face. He just stops responding. He just looks at Durbin like, whatever. That was a crazy exchange. Okay, so a couple legal questions I wanted to ask, I guess, Susan about, and, you know, if you have any thoughts on this, honey. What is the standard here? I keep seeing online people know, say over and over,
no,
you know.
Standard. There is no standard. Standard is, like, is this guy fit to be on the Supreme Court?
How, you know, I have never marched into a job interview like this. Honey, I'm guessing you haven't either.
No.
Even jobs that were not for the Supreme Court. So the whole idea of reasonable doubt, this is a complete false, like this is a red herring. It's bullshit. This is what, we are not in a criminal prosecution here.
Yeah. The only question here is like for the Senate to give advice and consent as to whether this guy is qualified. And he is demonstrably proven by anyone's standards, not an old white man who's feeling their privilege being threatened. He's not qualified. But right now, decisions are being made by old white men who feel their privilege being threatened. And by that standard, they think he passes.
It's just very... I said this before, but if your biopic could be an episode of Law & Order SVU, you're immediately disqualified. Like, you're immediately... If there's this kind of investigation, it's done. It should be finished by now.
Well, this is where I think the real crisis is approaching us, because what happened is, despite all predictions, he was not immediately sent... Well, he actually... That's untrue. So they had the committee. The Judiciary Committee had its vote, and it did, as expected, vote him out. What was unexpected is at the last minute, Flake flaked, and he
decided... I love that he just flakes each way possible.
Every way. Like, Flake is... It's almost it's really lazy writing.
It writes itself, yeah.
Yeah. But he decides that, you know what, I sometimes remember I like being a good person. I'm quitting this job anyway. I'm going to ask for an FBI investigation, which, thank you. That makes total sense, because this should happen.
Here's the thing, though. Friday morning, before the vote was going to take place, Flake put out a statement saying that he was going to confirm him.
Yeah.
And so between that time and as he's trying to get to the Senate Judiciary Chamber, he is stopped in an elevator by these two women who, if you see the video, I mean, it's pretty heart-rending. It's, you know, they're talking about, and one of the women's like, this is the first time I remember saying this out loud, that this happened to me. I was raped, like, you know, decades ago. Her mother found out about it for the first time hearing her daughter on the news. And Flake's face, he looks kind of crushed. He can't even look at them. And they're like, look at me. Yeah. And then like, it's like intrigue and drama kind of unfold in the chamber because Flake gets up and disappears. He's like gone for 90 minutes. All the Democrats leave the room.
He forfeits his comments.
Right. He yields his time. He leaves the chamber. Almost every Democratic senator leaves also. They're all like in this room outside the chamber. Then a couple of the, I think Orrin Hatch gets up to see what the hell's going on. And then he comes back and what does he say? He does vote him out of committee, but there's a condition, right?
The condition is that there is a request for the White House to do a FBI, reopen the background check, limited to 1 week time period to investigate sanctions. Which again, should have been done 2 weeks ago when it was first asked for, and they would be done with this by now. So the delay, like it makes perfect sense to do this. Whatever happens in any universe should want to at least do basic legwork to make sure that there's not something obvious and horrible hanging out there that's easily proven to just ask some questions. Because right now, here's a big part of Ford's story is that typically when someone's going to make a false accusation, they're not going to put witnesses there at the scene. She says there was two people there. Mark Judge was there, she says, but Mark Judge was not called in for questioning. So the FBI investigation has been reopened. And this, you know, my guess, when I first heard that, I was like, okay, fine. They're probably going to investigate and they're probably going to say no clear evidence and confirm him because that was the most likely path they were on. And that's probably why Flake agreed to be honest, because he called Rosenstein. And Rosenstein was like, I mean, we can reopen it and do it in a week, but the odds of finding something new are pretty low, so whatever.
But is there a
what kind of bullshit is that?
That's not bullshit. That's not bullshit. That's like, you know, that's the process. Like the process does matter, and actually using the process matters, and they should have done it from the start. So if the process was done properly and nothing was found that was like significant enough to warrant it, like, okay, fine. That's how it works.
Does an investigation involve interviewing Judge and Squee and all the people in the calendar? Do you think that'll definitely be a part of it? And is it possible that one of them will crack?
Well, here's where the constitutional crisis is approaching, because an investigation into this, at the very minimum, should include interviewing the victim and the accused assailant. And it turns out that there was a list of four people that the White House authorized the FBI to interview. Four people, full stop. And that's it.
The four people
are Mark Judge, PJ Smith, and Deborah Ramirez, and Leland Kaiser, the female friend of the party.
Ford.
Mm-hmm. But not on that list is Kavanaugh or Ford herself, which means from the start, it's a joke.
Well, Kavanaugh and Ford have both given testimony under oath.
That was nothing. That was nothing. That was not actual questioning. That's not, you need to actually make him answer questions, which he didn't do and didn't have to do because he ran the clock out. You would need the FBI to get in there and to find out what's true and what's not, and to get from him answers about like, okay, what kind of parties did you go to? What kind of dates? What does this mean on your calendar? What does that mean on your calendar? We heard this from this witness. Does that match up with what you recall? You have to talk to them both. And without that, you can't even have an investigation.
Well, they're basically like, let's walk down these dead ends again. Because, like, you're interviewing his friends. I mean, those are likely going to be dead ends. I mean, that's not an investigation if you can't look
like
outside
Judge
the scope.
I feel like Judge could crack.
Well, they're likely, no, because he won't crack because he knows that there can be no follow-up. If you were being interviewed and you know that no one, the person talking to you, can't actually check your answers, yeah, you're going to lie. If you want to, if you feel inclined to. But
if I was his lawyer, I'd be like, you're not lying to flipping FBI.
It's possible. Like
he can also say, I don't recall. Like that's your best answer for the.
I was blacked out the whole time. I don't recall. But the problem is, what does he recall? He can't say he does not recall any party he spent with his best buddy, Kavanaugh.
He wrote about it. He has a memoir, right? He's got a memoir.
He remembered enough to have a memoir. So he remembered enough to talk to the FBI. So this is where we get into the crisis zone, because what they're trying to do is to claim that there is a limitation, when in fact there is. Now, the smart political move would be to do like a reasonably limited scope of investigation for 1 week, and your odds are very good that they're not going to find anything going to change the general narrative, and you confirm him and you move on, and legitimacy for the court is salvaged to some degree. That would be the smart move in any universe, and they should have done it sooner. But they're not doing it, and it could be because they're totally incompetent. Who knows? That's definitely explains some of their behavior. But the overall impression is that they're not doing it because they know that Kavanaugh couldn't survive it.
So I've always been intimidated in investing. I'm one of those people who I don't invest in anything. I really have never done that. It's just one of those things that I don't know how it works. But Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, options, ETFs, and cryptos all commission-free in a non-intimidating way for stock market newcomers like me. They strive to make financial services that work for everybody, not just the wealthy. It is simple and intuitive, a really clear design of the app with data presented in an easy-to-digest way. I downloaded the app on my phone the other day. It took just a couple of minutes to set it up and get approved. And I'm kind of having fun with this. I've never tried anything like this. It's exciting to watch my money grow. And I haven't had to make big investments. Like, I don't have that kind of money, people. And you don't have to. And because I don't have that kind of money, I don't want to spend it on, like, the kinds of fees other brokerages charge. They charge up to 10 bucks for every trade, but Robinhood doesn't charge any commission fees. So you can trade stocks and keep all of your profits. So I'm learning by doing. I'm learning how to invest as I'm building my portfolio. I'm discovering new stocks and tracking favorite companies. I've got a personalized news feed. And, you know, I also want to invest in ethical stocks so I can, you know, make those decisions. You get custom notifications for price movements, so you never miss the right moment to invest. Now, Robinhood is giving listeners a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help build your portfolio. Let me repeat that. Our listeners are getting a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint, huge companies, to build your portfolio. All you gotta do is sign up at the45th.robinhood.com. Once again, sign up at the45th.robinhood.com, get your app set up quick and easy, and start investing for a better future.
Do you follow the president on Twitter?
I don't think I can handle it. I just basically, if a tweet shows up on the news or people are talking about a particular tweet, I then read it and maybe comment on it, but I can't. Partly out of ego, like, I don't think I could comedically with him, and I think it's probably best not to deal with it. Well, that was an attempt at a joke, by the way.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Yes. It's hard with this guy. I mean, we laugh, we weep, we do what you can. Well, he just tweeted out yesterday that the NBC News is incorrectly reporting that I limited the FBI investigation and witnesses to certain people. Actually, I want them to interview whoever they deem appropriate at their discretion. Are those marching orders, Susan? Would that trump anything else that they've been told to do?
That's an important question. And this is where the crisis is being set up, because in theory, it ought to. But the White House, the FBI source reported in news the next day they had not received new orders. They did not consider it to be a change of their orders. So now you have Trump publicly claiming there's one set of rules being issued and applied, but in practice, they are, you know, the executive agencies aren't following those rules. So we now have like an inability to know what the government is being ordered to do, because mm-hmm. what Trump says he's ordering is not matching what they say they're being ordered to do, and there's not a clear answer as to which is the real set of orders.
Huh.
It's going to
drag
out. This
is part of Trump's, but you know, this is his brilliance, I think, in many ways, right? This is how he just throws bombs into every. That's what he just blows shit up. He blows shit up,
and then renames it and slaps his name on it and calls it a win for him.
What he's doing here is, you know, like, I also wonder, can those official documents that give the order, can, I think Senator Feinstein, or I think she has requested the Department of Justice to give her, like, you know, to give the Senate Judiciary whatever the White House told them that they are supposed to do, so we have like a baseline. But the reality, it doesn't matter. Trump just says, nope, that's not true, and here we are. Well, one thing I forgot to talk about, and that was there were so many white men having epic meltdowns on Thursday, and we forgot the poor single white guy from South Carolina.
Oh, can we just keep forgetting him?
Did you watch that, honey, or did you catch it at all?
No, I didn't.
Oh,
Lindsey Graham.
Sad.
Oh, Lindsey. Oh, I did see Lindsey Graham, and Lindsey Graham is such. I mean, he's such a pathetic figure because he's such a panderer.
So
and like, I just remember when Trump was about to get the nomination, how depressed he was, and how he's making fun of his party being a failure, and, you know, with the expectation they were going to lose the election. And now all of a sudden he flips completely. Like, there is absolutely no integrity whatsoever.
There is integrity there, and that Lindsey Graham has stayed true to his love of war. And he realized Trump has, you know, a few warts here and there, to put it lightly. But Trump is the most likely person to ever give Lindsey Graham his dream of bombing the shit of every country.
Which is
what? Like, going to war,
no,
everywhere and anywhere.
I never knew that Lindsey Graham was
Lindsey Graham loves war more than Bolton loves war.
You know, I thought people were saying he's angling for a cabinet position, like he's thinking Sessions is out. And I'm, although, AG, why would he want that job?
Yeah, AG or somewhere where he can go to war. That's what he wants to do.
I read this report about how he's often seen dining all by himself in different restaurants.
Yeah, it's so sad. I like also when he gave his speech where he got angry on behalf of Kavanaugh. He's like, oh no, this was actually the next day when they put him out of committee. Graham's like, I know that I am a single white man from the South and everyone tells me to shut up. And everyone's like, wait, okay, so I know there's like a Republican talking point that like white men are told to shut up, but I'm not aware of like a single white man being a special category of like, you know, subject to like persecution right now. That seemed like that came out of
the persecution of single men.
Yeah, like I don't think that's even a right wing talking point. I think like maybe an incel talking point.
Also, like even if they're told to shut up, I don't remember them ever shutting up.
Yeah,
it's not working. I know. So Mitchell's report, I was kind of shocked, and I haven't actually read it, but I've read like the headlines. The sex crime prosecutor, Rachel Mitchell, she issued a report today in which basically she said, oh, this witness, meaning Christine, Dr. Ford, not credible. I wouldn't prosecute this case.
She focuses on things how at one point Ford used the word sexual assault to describe what happened to her, and at one point used the word physical assault to describe what happened to her. So that is apparently an inconsistency. It means that she cannot be believed and wouldn't prosecute the case. Now, this is an insane document because it comes from someone who is on leave but presumably going to return to being a sex crimes prosecutor. And I can just about guarantee that she's going to have defendants that she's prosecuting bring this up to explain why this woman in some case comes before that she's prosecuting can't be believed.
So she'll be excused. I mean, she requesting that she be removed from the case, basically.
No. Telling the jury, look at all these reasons that you can't believe a victim. And they're all present here.
Right. And this prosecutor is the one who actually gave us those reasons. Yeah, that's true. That's true. You guys watched the SNL premiere last night? Or was it, I mean, the night before? I don't know what day is today. Yeah, sorry. Did you guys watch it?
I didn't watch it, but I saw the Matt Damon clip, which is unbelievable.
Unbelievable. I was like, so on point. Kanye lost his mind on the show, or maybe it's not even lost. You have to go back. You have to go watch the Kanye pieces, but you have to watch the cold open, which is the hearing, which is Kavanaugh. I mean, Matt Damon's Kavanaugh. He's just fantastic. And it's kind of like when they used to spoof Palin, and they didn't have to change anything really to do that. They just basically took his words. So you guys should check that out. He was spooky on it.
I did go back and watch last week the SNL sketch from the Anita Hill hearings. And that was
I didn't know there was one.
Yeah.
How did they cover it did they cover that well?
They covered it well, but it was more the fact that everything seemed so modern still.
Yeah.
That was depressing. They just had this panel of white dudes like staring her down and being like, go on, tell us more about this sexy sex stuff. Mm. And then it ended with like Long Dawn Silver, like doing the Welcome to Saturday Night.
Oh my God. I forgot about that. Okay. So I guess what we're looking forward to now is like this whole week will be whatever the investigation is. But having said that, there are other classmates and colleagues and people who knew Kavanaugh basically when he was a young drunk asshole who are coming forward and saying he was lying basically in his testimony. What happens if he's lying? He's perjured himself. Now what? Can somebody charge him? What can happen here?
They never will. They never will.
The Senate won't charge him, obviously. Right?
No. I mean, again, it's the irony of this whole thing is that the guy who, you know, got a big start in his career and going after Clinton because Clinton, meaning of sex is, I mean, okay, so theoretically, we could have the same situation happen again because his Fox News testimony was entered into the record and he adopted it as his own testimony. Oh, okay. So he has now gone on the record saying he was a virgin in high school. So if they can prove he had sex in high school, he's like committed the crime that he wanted Clinton impeached for.
Once you're on the Supreme Court, is there any way you can remove a justice? Is there any kind of mechanism to...
Are we talking theoretically or practically?
Theoretically.
Yes. Practically,
impeachment.
No.
Well, why not? Why not 67, practically? Why can't we do this, damn it?
67 votes. Not going to happen.
Oof.
I mean, unless there is a blue wave, like a blue tsunami.
Not 67. Maybe. Never going to happen. I think maybe 2030 in the world. And we're not going to have in like a decade from now a huge blue wave because guess what? You know, red states still get two senators and they're going to have like 70% of the population like and like, or 30% of the population, like 70% of the votes, if not more than that. So yeah,
well, I still hope RGB kicks his ass. But all right, so we're gonna wrap up. But Hadi, I just realized a little while ago that you're actually gonna be in my neighborhood, Baltimore, not just this week, right?
Yeah, I'm touring all over the country, but it starts in Baltimore on the 3rd, and then I'm going to Florida, touring for the first time, which hopefully are not my last dates in Florida.
okay.
Tampa, Fort Lauderdale, and Orlando. Then I hit Chicago and Minneapolis on the 11th and 12th, and then I finish all my touring for the year at the last week of October. Columbus, Ohio, Providence, Rhode Island, Boston, Massachusetts, New Brunswick, New Jersey. I expect a lot of South Asians there. And Hamden, Connecticut. So, yeah, I'll be touring all over, and my dates are on hurricanebolu.com, and I hope people come to the shows.
I am totally going to try to come out this Wednesday. It all comes down to childcare for me, but that's just the life I live. But where can people find you online?
You can find me at Hari Kundabolu on Twitter or on Facebook or HariKundabolu.com. But more realistically, considering my name, I would try Google. I think Google is probably the best bet you'll have to find Hari Comedian, and you'll figure it out from there. But yeah, my website is Google.com.
Yeah. And folks, check out Hari's podcast as well. And hopefully we'll hear your mom on that sometime, maybe as a special guest. If she gets
some
time.
We did. We had my mom as the special guest the last episode of the Kundabolu Brothers for season one. And she shreds both of us. She destroys both of us publicly. It's very good.
I know what I'm listening to today.
Yeah, it's very good.
Big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible, and I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products, and thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer Meethal Thelhan, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is at 45thpod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.